and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me today. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Sukil Day. I'm talking to you today from Central Arundeland in Mbatwe, which is also known as Alice Springs in the Northern Territory in the very middle of Australia.
Excellent. And I'm down south in Adelaide, and that's actually Kaurna Land. So kind of directly underneath each other. To start off the journey first, how did you get into midwifery?
Completely by accident. I never, ever, ever wanted to be a midwife. I got into nursing, and that was a really good way of escaping Canberra, because it meant I could go to Sydney and live there for 3 years. So that was, I got into nursing, and I at one stage, I did a year post-grad, and then I did what you do back in those days and hitchhiked around Australia with a friend, and ended up in Alice Springs. And when I was in Alice Springs, I can't remember whether it was then or, like, I just loved it. I ended up going back a couple of times in those early years, and at one stage I did a short, they were desperate for nurses, mm-hmm. they had a rotavirus outbreak, and I did a short stint there at the hospital in the pediatric infectious diseases ward, and it opened my eyes to a world mm-hmm. that I just didn't know existed in this country. So I thought, my God, you know, I've never really heard of rotavirus. Mm-hmm. These are the sickest kids I've ever seen in my life, and I didn't learn anything about any of this in my schooling, in my nursing, just couldn't believe it. And I just thought the Great Australian Outback was just amazing, and I thought I want to work for the Flying Doctors. So to do that, of course, I had to do midwifery. So I had, in between, I was sort of moved around a lot, travelling a lot, and picking up nursing when I could. I went back and I thought, I did intensive care first. Mm-hmm. Thought that would be the go. Loved intensive care. Thought that I'd always do stuff like that, you know, the emergency department, yep. ICU sort of stuff. But then, of course, still had to do the midwifery if you're going to work for the Flying Doctors. So I did it just because I felt I had to. And I quite liked it. But it was always really just to do something else, which was the Flying Doctors. So I ended up going back. I ended up in Alice Springs, which is where I am now, many, many years ago, doing sort of my postgrad mm-hmm. work there, and still wanting to get a job with the Flying Doctors, which I eventually got.
Cool.
And that was over in Derby in the Kimberley region of the very, very top of Western Australia. Mm-hmm. So I finally got my job with the Flying Doctors, and, of course, there you fly all over Aboriginal land to very small Aboriginal communities, where we used to do this crazy thing and bring women in to have their babies many, many, many hours away from their home communities, away from their families, and away from, you know, where they're comfortable. And even if they had their baby out bush, they'd still send the plane and we'd pick the women up and bring them in. And I don't know, I think back then it was, you'd say, why are we going to get a mother and baby a well? Why don't we leave them in the community? No, yeah. No, you've got to bring them in. We've got to check them, you know, that sort of language. And, of course, it was, I don't know, some people used to think it's just to try and teach them a lesson, let them know they can't have their babies out there. They're still going to come in. I don't know if it was or it wasn't. You know, I felt like a pawn in a system that was just wrong. And it was, you know, I slowly learnt about what we were doing to our First Nations Australians, about colonisation and the enduring impacts of colonisation. I learnt about, you know, remote area maternity services and the lack of remote area maternity services, and, the, you know, witnessed the closure over years. And you know, that the working for the Flying Doctors made me realise that I didn't really know what it was like to be out bush. So next step after that, you know, with a few overseas trips in between always, was to try getting a job as a remote area nurse midwife, which, you know, I've now worked in many communities in that role, and it's one of the most extraordinary roles you can do in Australia. It's just so much fun, really. Incredible learning, incredible journey of getting to understand what's happening in remote Aboriginal communities. And, you know, if you're lucky like I was mentored by, you know, extraordinary Aboriginal health workers and Aboriginal mentors that taught me a lot about not only Aboriginal health and Aboriginal well-being, but about myself at the end of the day, of course. So, yeah.
What type of things did you learn about yourself?
Oh, you learn a lot about yourself when you're working out in a remote area place. I mean, we used to work in, I mean, back in those days, so this is through the 90s, really. Back in those days, like you were lucky if you had doctors in the remote community. Mostly you didn't. Or you might have them flying out one or two days a week to, you know, communities where you've got an extraordinary burden of disease, where you're seeing, you know, things like trachoma, tuberculosis, rheumatic heart disease, rheumatic fever, things that, you know, you kind of learn about but not much. And way do you do things, you know, that are beyond your scope of practice, because if you don't do them, you know, people die. So you feel as though you're in one of those tricky, very tricky places where you do your best sometimes. So you learn to work under sometimes very extraordinary stress. You learn to work in a team, a multidisciplinary team. You learn to trust each other in ways that you don't, you know, you do see it, of course, in big teams in big city hospitals, but it's very different when the people you're socialising with are the people that you're also working with side by side, but might also be the people that you're treating, you know, coming through or in an emergency, they've just had a rollover and there's, you know, somebody who's, you know, your colleague. So, yeah, you learn a lot about working in a way that we don't necessarily work in other areas, and learning to listen to Aboriginal communities, to the people, to the health workers. I think over years, I learned that, you know, the way I used to work in when I first went bush was not very good. Like, I wasn't a culturally safe clinician.
Yeah.
Never had any cultural awareness or cultural safety training or anything in years in many of the states and territories. You know, I worked in Queensland remote communities. I worked in the Northern Territory in multiple communities, Western Australia. Yeah, that wasn't something that we got back then. So you had to learn by trial and error, and often making mistakes, and not really understanding what you were doing. And plus with your nursing training, you come in, I think you come into, you know, very task orientated,
yes,
overwhelmed with the jobs that you need to do, completely overwhelmed with, you know, the lists of kids that haven't had their monthly bicillin, and if they don't have it, you know, what's going to happen to them? They've got rheumatic heart disease, and, you know, here's another list of the people that should have had x-rays just because they're TB contacts, and here's another list of, you know, the pap smears that are due, and another list of the, you know, 36 antenatal women at any one time, and, you know, there's a small number of you, and you're never going to do it. So you have to learn how to work in a way that we weren't taught, and how to be an advocate and how to lobby and how to, you know, I got in trouble multiple times for talking to ministers and trying to highlight, you know, say, let the community know, let people know that, you know, this sort of staffing is not good enough, and then you get in trouble because you're not supposed to talk to ministers or the media or anyone else, and you think, well, who's going to speak on behalf of this community? So you had to get really clever at ways you shared information, and so I became very good at doing community newsletters and, you know, other things like that. And I also learned about health as not, you know, the lists and jobs that we had to do. that wasn't what was going to change the health of that community. Yeah. You know, sure, on an individual basis, important that every woman gets her bicillin needle, but, oh, woman and man, but, you know, it was more about working with the organisations in the community to help identify what they thought were the health issues and get the community involved in the solutions, all that community development side of things that, you know, it took me a long time to learn a lot of that sort of stuff, but that was what was going to make a difference to the health of people at the end of the day. Mm. You know, because, you know, four nurses in a clinic for, you know, 2,500 people with a high burden of disease was never going to cut the mustard. I mean, I think now they've got over, oh, I can't remember how many it is, but in one of the communities where there was four of us, I think there's now about 40 or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's still not what's needed.
We still have a gap. We still have a gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous that we shouldn't never have. And it's like we've been working on it for so long. It feels like we're still not breaching it much. How did that get you into research with that experience and a lot of the advocacy experience, which comes in handy for research? How did you then step into your research career?
Yeah, I'll talk you through it. It was another sort of an accident, but I've just been writing here. A report just came out talking about the gap. So there's actually a report that just came out has shown that First Nations Australians experience a disease burden of 2.3 times other Australians, which, you know, we know. So for preterm birth, it's almost double the rates. For infant mortality, it's almost double the rates. For maternal mortality, so mothers dying in childbirth, it's anywhere between 3 and 5 times the rate. So the disease burden is extraordinary. And there's a piece of work's been done and released by the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. A $4.4 billion gap in government and private health expenditure has been identified for First Nations health expenditure in Australia. So that equates to at least $5,000 per person. And there's two more reports that have come out showing how little Medicare is being utilised, which should be. And all of that brings you back to thinking about midwifery and Medicare. And, you know, at the moment, midwifery, all, you know, I sat on a panel. I know I'm going all over the place now, but that's on a panel that was, you know, the review of Medicare. We handed down our reports in 2018 with recommendations of what should happen to Medicare for midwives. And, you know, it's a long, slow process trying to get stuff done through bureaucracy. And we've had about 10 of the 18 recommendations implemented, which is fantastic, but we need the others implemented. Mm. And, like, midwifery is primary healthcare. And if you can get that Medicare working, particularly in the Aboriginal community-controlled health sector, in the rural areas, in the remote areas, then you can have midwives across the whole of rural and remote Australia. But at the moment, there's all these barriers to the funding working. And it's actually, you look around remote Australia now, so there used to be an unwritten law or even a written kind of a law in the old days that you had to have triple certificates when you went and worked out.
Yep.
Yeah, you had to have emergency skills, you had to have midwifery or child health or something else. It's not like that anymore. You look at across the remote Northern Territory, we've hardly got any midwives out there. So you wonder why we've got 1 in 5 babies in the Galawinkie community that we're working with at the moment. So almost between 18 and 22% any one year are being born too soon and too small. So that is insane.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane. So our country is just, the structural barriers that prevent best practice are alive and well. Mm. And we have to be very political. We've got to get more organised as a profession. We've got to be better advocates. We've got to be more organised with the consumers. There's a lot of work we still need to do.
Do you see that as a role for endorsed midwives or for any midwife? Should we be expanding that scope to include that, or is that in particular for, or both of them working together in the remote areas?
I think The skills and knowledge that we need and attitudes of the midwife that we need in remote areas is a little bit different to, you know, what we get in our general midwifery training.
Yep.
Midwives that go on and do endorsement are learning about primary healthcare and PBS and Medicare and all of that sort of stuff, setting up small businesses. That's great. Mm-hmm. And the reason endorsed midwives would be good out bush is that they're able to bring Medicare in, so they can mm-hmm. almost pay for themselves, which means it brings more money into remote Australia or into the Aboriginal community controlled health organisations. Do we need midwives who aren't endorsed? Definitely. You know, we need as many midwives as we can get. And you might have midwives that are not endorsed, but they've, they're skilled midwives. Mm. Great. Mm. Absolutely, we need them out bush. But we need to do it in a way that's actually going to increase the continuity of care and a way that you're going to be able to enable that midwife to continue their scope of practice and to not get de-skilled. So if you put a midwife out bush and she's not doing intrapartum care, then very quickly they'll become de-skilled and probably a little bit frightened about birth. So, you know, we need to look at continuity models that go across remote Australia and into the tertiary units, wherever it is that they're going, and actually enable midwives to work in those models where you're actually you can go and spend 3 months in Alice Springs Hospital and then you can, if you want, and you're still part of the same team that's giving outreach to, say, Tennant Creek or whatever, but have these, and they're not virtual teams, they're actually, modified midwifery group practices, so that you're improving the communication, the collaboration, the, you know, less chance of women falling through the cracks, and also for the midwives, you're enabling them to work in different settings and supporting them to upskill in the remote setting where they will see things that they, you know, they didn't learn in the school. I mean, we've done a lot of talk recently about, you know, what are the skills that you need and the knowledge that you need for working in these settings, because not everybody can.
No.
Yeah.
It definitely takes a unique personality to be able to deal with the isolation, with the demands, with the quite often 24 hours you don't turn off, you're part of the community, so you can get knocks on the doors at any time and you don't get that chance to kind of get set holidays always depending on when you can get coverage. But it does take a very unique person to be able to thrive in those areas.
Yeah, although the more we improve the system and the service to make it a service that's not depending on the individual, the more people would be attracted and supported and able to do it. So, you know, we should still be able to, you know, open it up to a lot of anyone that's interested really and just try and look at, okay, what kind of training do they need? What kind of support do they need? What do we need to put in place? And my PhD was on it was all about how do you support remote area midwives.
So that's a beautiful segue then.
Yeah. So I got into it by accident. So I was somebody convinced me to do my honours when I was a remote area nurse midwife. And I did what I now know is a huge honours. It was a 50,000 word thesis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I mean, I didn't know back then. It's back in the early days when we, you know, we did, I don't know. Anyway, so I got talked into doing that and, of course, I got first class honours. And then somebody said, well, you know, now you have to go on and do a PhD. I'm going, what do I want to do a PhD for? I just want to do a master's in the Northern Territory. Anyone that got the big jobs had to have their master's, but honours wasn't recognised as anything. So I kind of felt a bit gypped.
Yep.
And I didn't even realise back then that honours was research training and that, you know, really if you want to be an academic in a university, you should definitely do honours and go on and do your PhD. But I didn't even really know that. I was so naive and had been, you know, the whole thing I'd done distance. And, yeah, anyway, so when I did it, I sort of, first class was great. It's just like, oh, now what? You know, what, I'm a master's and, like, I've just done a 50,000 word. You know, can't I roll this into a master's?
So what did you do your honours on? What was that topic?
Infertility. Okay. So I was a women's health nurse and the midwife in the women's health room in a remote community, and I was really surprised at the number of women that were asking support to have a baby and wanting help and needing help to in investigations to see whether they had a problem with infertility or not. So I looked at infertility. It was my honours, yeah. So, and that, and it did eventually lead to me doing, because it wasn't kind of the, I didn't really want to do a master's. I thought I'm going to have to do a PhD. and I made the fatal mistake of somebody said, oh, have you met Leslie Barclay? And I went, no, oh, yeah, you should go down to Sydney and meet Leslie Barclay. And I don't think I ever got down to Sydney initially. I think it was Pat Brody that told me to do that. I'd met her at a conference in Darwin.
Yep.
And I didn't know, I wasn't a very political midwife. I didn't know all of these famous midwives back then.
Yep.
And, it was Pat Brody who said, oh, just give Leslie, contact her. And I did end up contacting her and had a phone call with her and send her my CV or something or other. Anyway, I don't know. Do you know Leslie Barclay?
I know that she's one of our doyens of midwifery, and I'm trying to get her, trying to get in contact with her for an interview as well.
Oh, yeah, she'd be great. I mean, she's extraordinary, and she's just, once she knows you're there, she gets your hook in, and like in you come into her little, you know, this nest of it was extraordinary, really. It was eye-opening, and it was amazing, because I she was down at UTS in Sydney, and she had quite a lot of PhD students who are some of our most famous in Australia.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think she's done, I think it's about 36 or 38, she supervised 36 or 38 midwife students. Extraordinary.
She is kind of, when you think about it, the kind of almost like the mother or the grandmother of modern midwifery in Australia.
Yeah, so many went on to be professors. Mm. And, so I ended up doing my PhD, enrolling with Leslie, and Pat Brody was another one of my supervisors, and enrolled with them and sort of came and went. So I did a birthing business in the bush was my PhD, and I came and went between Manangreeta and UTS. But down at UTS there was this, you know, the other students or supervisors were people like, you know, Pat Brody, Nikki Lee, mm-hmm. there was Virginia Schmid, you know, the Marilyn Farrar was down there. There was, you know, Carol. There were so many of us that were all sort of hanging around and learning from all of these extraordinary mm-hmm. people. It was quite a journey. Yeah, quite a journey. So eye-opening, learning about midwifery, learning about the politics of midwifery, and learning about, just learning about Australian midwifery, really, which when you're out in remote, you know, out in the bush, you don't really, you know, really get involved in a lot of that sort of stuff.
Well, you're so distant from everything else that's happening in the cities that it's kind of, but you're also, by working in the areas that you're working, continuing on with like 60,000 years. So you're kind of being part of that amazing history,
which
not majority of people won't get to experience.
Yeah, and that was the beautiful thing about my PhD, because I ended up taking Leslie up to Manangreeta and introducing her to Molly Wadaguga, mm-hmm. who Molly is a, you know, a mentor of mine. She's passed away now, and we've established the Molly Wadaguga Research Centre in her honour. And she taught me a lot, and she was a key person that I worked side by side with as I did my doctoral work. And we both got, you know, the joint recipients of the UTS mm-hmm. Human Rights Award for Reconciliation, which was just beautiful. So, that was the beginning of, I mean, the PhD was hard because I actually, my first year, I wasn't going to do it in Manangreeta. I was going to do it out in, I was sort of, it was a project that wasn't really mine. It was Leslie was doing something. It was out in Western Sydney. It was around maternity services for a small rural Aboriginal community. And I spent about a year doing it and ended up having to throw the whole thing out and start again somewhere.
I know.
It was pretty crushing.
That's kind of your first year is so daunting once you start getting the groove, and then it's like, no, starting again.
Yeah. It was very political. It was very political, and I was just a little, you know, pawn in it all, and ended up sort of running away. Really, it was just like, oh my god, this is too hard, and this isn't what I wanted to do, and I'm not this. I don't belong here. So, you know, yeah, that was tough because I'd spent a year full time doing that.
What kept you going then?
Matt and Greta.
Right.
And Molly. Yeah. No, it was absolutely the right thing. The planets were aligning. They just took a while to do it. So, you know, I understand how students can go on these, you know, crazy journeys of, you know, doing something and it's going haywire and things aren't going the way they want, and then they have to turn around and go a different direction. I certainly can empathise with them. It doesn't make it any easier for the individual, but it's plenty of empathy from me and understanding. So, yeah, PhD journey I think is a really, really tough journey. It's, you know, it's not for everyone. It takes so much time and time is money, and, you know, it takes, you've got to be incredibly passionate, really. I think we expect a lot in Australia from our PhD students in midwifery. You know, I've seen other PhD journeys in, you know, I think in medicine it's not as hard as what it is for us. I think in some of the overseas countries it's nowhere near as hard as what we do here in Australia. We really expect very, very high quality work from our PhD doctoral students. Yeah, but I mean, it is what it is. But it's tough going, that's for sure. But, you know, it's fantastic once you've done it because the world opens up, doesn't it? There's so many, you know, it's not just to be a lecturer in a university. There's overseas jobs, there's WHO, there's you know, so many other people you can work for. And when you've got doctor in front of your name, it does make a bit of a difference sometimes.
It certainly opens doors and windows, and people listen, especially as Franca was saying that she was on lots of panels with Dr. Professor, and then Miss Franca, and then Kadi. And then as soon as she got the doctorate, it was just kind of like it was an even playing field. But by doing yours out bush and being so remote, how did you structure your study time then? Like, was majority of it kind of like remote with coming in for some residentials, or how did you kind of work around that?
Yeah, it was tough because I ended up moving down to Sydney to do it so that I was surrounded by people that were doing PhDs, and you get all that learning about, you know, being in a student cohort and having your buddies that are going through the same ups and downs that you're going through, and learning about their methods and methodology and, you know, all of this sort of stuff, which is it's like a different world, isn't it? So I moved down to Sydney. I got a grant, which because I got a scholarship initially, and then got a grant to do a project on remote area on my PhD, which was great.
Cool.
So that meant I could pay myself one day a week. That was good, a little bit helpful. But also working with Leslie, she was amazing because she had all these, you know, they'd be overseas projects, and she always wanted her students to have an opportunity to do various things. And because she was so internationally respected, she'd have all these projects. So, you know, sometimes, you know, you might take a break in your candidature and go off. I remember, you know, I did an amazing project with her in Sulawesi in Indonesia, which was really supposed to be about midwifery education, but really ended up being really looking at infection control and waste management, really, because they
are
important priorities. So I worked on that project for a couple of years with Leslie, going to and from, and that was amazing. So she had various other projects that you know, I managed to get a little bit of work on, and incredible learning. So that was you know, incredible. She was amazing, and certainly opened my eyes to a way of working, which was, you know, pretty impressive. So that was great. That helped financially. But what that meant is that my PhD took years.
It takes longer, so especially part-time or when you're intermitting it.
And when you lose the first year. So it took a very long time. But I'd go backwards and forwards to Man and Greta and spend a lot of time up there. But then I'd have to come back and, you know, about halfway through my PhD, I realised that I thought Molly and I were on the same page. But about halfway through, I realised she was expecting something completely different to what I was expecting.
Oh,
no. So I had to do both projects. So, of course, that felt like it just made the whole PhD even bigger. And, like, I've got this PhD that's about this thick, four separate sort of case studies, and it probably should have only been about one. But that's the way, you know, Molly really, really wanted the older women's stories documented, and she wanted them written down where everybody can read them. So, of course, we're not talking about, writing down serious women's business stuff, but just documenting some of the stories and that led to the Birthing Business in the Bush website, which is, you know, are still around today. It's still archived. You can get to it through the Molly Centre resources page, but it's archived in one of the national libraries as well as a
good. So it should be
important piece of historical knowledge. So that was amazing when they came and asked us if they could do that. But you know, there was a lot of learning there as well. A lot of learning about what could be written down and what couldn't be written down, and, you know, understanding, making sure that everybody in the community really understood the internet. That was back in the days before people understood the internet well. Molly understood it, but we had to make sure everybody else understood it. So that was a lot of sitting around in the sand with a laptop at night, telling stories and showing the internet and, explaining, you know, what this whole internet meant. Which was, interesting.
Little knowing how pervasive it was actually going to be in our lives in the future.
And I remember sitting down and one of the old ladies said a lot of this work was done through interpreters. Man and Greta's one of the most multilingual places in the world. Mm-hmm. So 52 languages have been documented in Man and Greta.
Wow.
So there's about 13 kind of main-ish languages there, but, you know, there's a lot of other little languages and dialects, and then, of course, there's been, German people there, et cetera, et cetera, that sort of thing. So, 52 is phenomenal, really. But so a lot of my work was with interpreters, and I had Molly as my co-researcher, and Margaret, another one of the most extraordinary, amazing Aboriginal health workers. So the two of them were my sort of guardians that made sure that I did things the right way, and they were paid researchers as well on the project. And we then had key people from each of the different language groups who were also, paid researchers and interpreters. So we were sitting down in one outstation at one stage, and one old lady said to me through an interpreter, "Is it true that there's a place in Darwin?" So she'd never been out of her outstation, let alone into Darwin. "There's a place in Darwin where the door opens up and you go into the door, and when it closes, you don't know where you are, but when it opens, you're somewhere completely different."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I'm going, it took me a while, and I just went, "A lift." She's talking about a lift. And I'm going, "A lift. Yes.
Wow.
That's a true story." So the young kids had come back and were telling her about this door that opens and takes you to a magic place that's not, you know, when it closes and then when it opens up, you're somewhere different. And it's like, it's a lift. So, I mean, that's the sort of stuff that I was learning about and sharing knowledge and working side by side and listening to the most amazing stories of the women with so much wisdom and so much midwifery knowledge, which, of course, Molly was. So she learned midwifery from the Ballander way, which was the you know, the Whitefella way, yep, when she went, did some training as an Aboriginal health worker in Darwin. But she also had learned midwifery from the Aboriginal elders in the community. And she was, you know, she always said, you know, the power of place. Mm. You know, if I was supporting women to have their babies in the camps and out in the community, then we'd do it Aboriginal way. We'd be, yep, you know, that in the warm sand and, you know, swinging from the trees and, you know, lots of the elders and grannies around her, et cetera, et cetera. If you're in Darwin, they give you a bowl and a razor until you have to shave the woman and give her a enema. And, like, she said, that she just laughed hysterically at that. And then if you're in the clinic, you tell people to get up on the beds.
Mm.
So she said, this is the way it's, you know, it's done. So the Ballina midwives are telling women to get up on the beds, and whereas, yeah, so it was interesting. And it's just the craziness, you know, of we've got the longest living culture in the world, yep, in this country here, and we just, you know, we push them away from the birthing room. We take, you know, instead of us going out to the remote communities and setting up and utilising that knowledge and making sure women feel safe in their communities, we rip women away from their communities. We don't take their elders with them.
Mm.
We're losing that knowledge. And that was a big thing that Molly said is, you know, the worst thing that's happening at the moment is about, you know, the loss of Aboriginal knowledge. Mm. So everything that we did in that PhD was to try and, particularly the work that Molly and Margaret were leading, was to try and make sure that that knowledge was still available.
So where can people access it? So I'm on the Birthing on Country website now.
Yeah.
So, and I'll put a link to that in with this podcast as well when it's released. So through the resources, that's a way, yeah, of getting through some of the, and kind of reading, there's a lot of stuff there, which is, but I think that's something that, I remember when I was in primary, like I was in primary school in the, so I'm 53, so in the 70s, and high school in the 80s. And looking at the education that we got on the First Nations and the Indigenous, we got more education in primary school than we ever did get in high school. In high school, there was, yeah, nothing, absolutely nothing. Yeah. Yeah. And in primary school, it was very much the settlers. It was kind of, we actually did learn about some of the Indigenous warriors and leaders, and then it kind of just disappeared to kind of go through that. And you think about, if we'd been told some of these stories beforehand, traveling around the country, you'd be picking the birthing trees a lot more than what you do now, because
absolutely,
it would be, we would be much better, yeah, and the advantage of what New Zealand's got with their treaty. But a lot of countries have done the same thing with discrimination and colonialism and just kind of destroyed the Indigenous cultures. But seeing some of it come back, and I'm thinking of the Canadian Inuits, that they're getting birthing back on country as well, and kind of taking, yeah, it back after support. But it's the power of the women, the power of the midwives, is the being the political and fighting up for it that's actually getting the drive back again, which is, it's just ridiculous that it's taken so much effort to do something that should be automatic.
Yeah, and we can't try and do it the way we did it before because it wasn't sustainable. We've got to work side by side with our Aboriginal communities and women and the knowledge holders in the communities to be able to do it in a way that's going to be right. So if you go onto that website, under the resources page, there's a few different, you know, it's not exhaustive by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a link to Birthing Business in the Bush, which was the website I was talking about.
Yeah.
It's old now, but it takes you to Trove, which is the library sort of page that it's been archived in. But also have a look on the under projects. There's some amazing work being done by one of our associate professors, Larapa Mapalama, and Dr. Sarah Ireland in the Galawinku community, so with the Yolnu community in northeast Arnhem Land. So if you go to the projects page, there's a project, Caring for Mum on Country, and another one called Jakamir.
Yeah.
And Jakamir is amazing. There's a little sort of a 3-minute clip there of the documentary. Have you seen it?
We're trying to get one of my students is actually trying to get a viewing of it and heard fabulous feedback on it.
So it's beautiful, beautiful work that we're doing up there. And it's really about centering Indigenous knowledge and working with the community to actually blend the knowledges. We're also working with the Australian Doula College. So Renee Adair, who's the CEO there, has been fantastic as well. And the project is all about honouring the Indigenous knowledge, but also blending it with the non-Indigenous knowledge. And we're developing educational modules which will end up being probably at certificate four level, maybe diploma level. So a pathway into midwifery if people want. But we're looking at testing the role of the Jacamere. So for all of those women that have to leave their remote communities for birth, we're saying that they should have a Jacamere with them. So a childbirth and a Yolngu childbirth companion who knows them, who knows their culture, who understands, you know, the Western words, the knowledge, you know, what's happening in the birthing room, all these scary things that, you know, I don't even know how women, you know, how we get informed consent. I think most of the time it's informed for so many of these procedures.
Oh, yeah.
Half the time they don't even have interpreters available for women. So the Jacamere is it's a beautiful project. So we've done a pilot project. We've run the education several times. We're now getting funding for or applying for. We've just got another 5-year project to further develop the birthing on country sites. So we've had the urban site where we did a big project. So this is what happens after you do a PhD. If you're like me, you end up becoming ridiculously passionate about research and understanding that research can be a very powerful tool for change, for advocacy, for, you know, it's a very, very powerful tool, and that's why I love it. And the projects that we've got, I mean, we've got a lot of projects, and you can see them on the Birthing on Country website or the Molly Wadaguga website on the Charles Darwin Uni website. So, you know, we've sort of grown, and, you know, we've got too many websites now. We've got to try and work out how to sort it all out.
Connect them all.
Social media, and we need the young ones to come on and sort all this out for us. But anyway, they are helping, and our team is growing, our work is expanding, and we're working so always side by side with Aboriginal colleagues and at the Molly Centre. Professor Yvette Rowe is the co-director with me. So Molly taught me that I must always be working side by side with Aboriginal colleagues, and Yvette and I are the co-directors, and we've got a team of people and a lot of Aboriginal nurses, midwives, researchers, students, you know, and various community-based researchers. So we're doing a lot to, you know, we're doing our part in growing the various roles and employment, you know, the social determinants of health. But we've got a long way to go, and we've got the urban birthing on country, birthing in our community project that, you know, we got published in The Lancet twice, reduced preterm birth by 50%.
Yep.
Phenomenal results from that study has now led to more studies where we've got the rural site, which is down in Nowra, working really close with the Waminda community and the amazing community down there, and Mel Briggs, who's you know, a fabulous Aboriginal midwife, and that's all on the Ewan lands. The remote site is going to be here, working with Congressa Lucra, so here in Alice Springs, which of course is where Congressa Lucra, the grandmother's law, you know, the report of the grandmother's law is on our resources pages. That's from the late 80s, and the work that women requested way back then. There's a lot of reports, they all pretty much say the same thing, and we never really managed to, you know, do what people asked. We're very good at consulting, just not very good at the implementing the recommendations. So then the very remote site is the East Arnhem site.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so we've got the urban, the rural, the remote, and the very remote. And what we're trying to do is use research to establish best practice models for those different areas that can then be scaled up across the country. So that's what we're hoping.
how do we go about, or what are the barriers, getting more Indigenous midwives?
Yeah, look, good question. That's a whole part of our work. So we've got a framework, and it's on if you look at the MWRC website, if you put the link to that in the chat as well, or in the podcast, that's our Molly Wadaguga Research Centre mm-hmm. website. And if you look at the RISE framework,
mm-hmm.
yep. this is a framework that we think could probably be adapted to just about anything, like, you know, juvenile justice, education, all sorts of different areas. We use it in health services research and for mums and bubs and across the first 1,000 days or first 2,000, you know, up to age mm-hmm. five. So the four pillars in the RISE framework are redesigning the health service, and, of course, you know, midwives are great at that with continuity of care. We know mm-hmm. that it's needed. Investing in the workforce, and that's all about growing the Aboriginal workforce, mm. but also making sure that the non-Aboriginal workforce is culturally competent. So we've got a big program of work that's going on at Charles Darwin University. We've got two of our key Indigenous leaders in our leadership team, Professor Roy-Ann West, who's mm-hmm. also CEO of CATSNAM, the Congress of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander mm-hmm. Nurses and Midwives, and Professor Juanita Sherwood, who's, you know, famous really for decolonising methodology. Mm. She's a nurse and a midwife, and she's an extraordinary Indigenous leader. And I've known her since we did nursing together, so we're old mates. So I just love the fact that we're back working together again. So we're getting guidance from Roy-Ann and from Juanita into, you know, what can we do? CATSNAM's doing an enormous amount of work in this area. Rodanthe Lipset Trust is also, you know, looking at supporting the midwives. What we know in Australia is that lots of people enrol, and often, you know, they might complete some of the course, mm. but they often don't. They don't all complete. So it's not recruitment, it's retention that we have to work on. And we know that our universities and our hospitals are, you know, the institutional racism is just horrendous. And
yes,
we had, you know, we had cadets embedded in, you know, the Birthing Our Community program. A lot of the interviews that we've done with various Aboriginal student midwives just make you want to cry. Mm. Like our systems are so horrendous, and people don't understand structural disadvantage, and they don't understand inequity.
Mm.
And our midwifery and nursing colleagues are, you know, part of the problem, not part of the solution. So, you know, you hear things like, well, why should they get extra help? And what is it that, why are they any more special than anyone else? It's like, do you not understand the structural inequities? And no, of course they don't, because they haven't been taught it. So unless they've done their own deep reflection and learning about social justice, about colonisation and the enduring impact of colonisation, trauma-informed care, you know, mm-hmm. all of these things that we're not teaching when we should be teaching, that reflective practice. If our nurses and midwives and our university lecturers, you know, if they haven't done that personal journey and that personal work, and they probably haven't learnt it in their courses, then of course they're ignorant to it. And you know, ignorant, I'm not saying ignorant in a bad way, they're ignorant, they just don't know. And they don't know what they don't know, and they don't see it. So you hear things like people say, oh, I don't see colour. It's just like, don't say that to me. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, what are you trying to say there? So it's trying to get people to understand the incredible social injustice in this country,
mm.
the structural disadvantages and barriers that need to be taken down, our part in that, and how we can actually work together. I mean, how many have read the Uluru Statement? How many understand truth and, you know, the treaty, the justice that is needed? How many understand how important a voice to Parliament is?
Yeah.
How many people even understand why we want to change the date? Like, it's such a simple thing. Well,
even the Constitution, like the main document addressing in Constitution.
Underpins our country.
I was telling my students the other day that until 1967, the Indigenous people were still seen as kind of fauna. And it's they're kind of going, what's that? I said, well, that's animals.
It's very uncomfortable learning, isn't it?
And we have that same racism that's actually going to affect globally midwifery when we look at the Roe and Wade situation in America as well.
Oh, get me started on that.
That's that social issue. That's that social politics as well of all of this. It's intergenerational trauma. It's international trauma that will still affect because we'll still have people, well, they've done it over here, so now that we can overturn and stuff. It is frightening.
It's terribly frightening, and it's the right-wing movement. It's the anti-feminist movement. It's the movement against women. It's trying to put us back in our little boxes where we can be controlled. It's horrendous, and it is. I think it's terrifying what's happening in the United States at the moment. Mm. And anyway, you'd be a fool not to think that there's going to be repercussions across the whole of the world following this. So it's been a concerted effort. You know, people like, Amy.
The judge.
Michael Judge, yeah.
But that was it. Trump's position, and this is where we're getting into politics, but the whole point was to get High Court judges on. And when you look at they did what they were meant to do, and we've got the...
She's wanted this for years.
Yep. And years. So they've got the sway now is very much conservative. And they've been doing it with government policy. We're not so good and we're not as better because we've been, that's poor English. That's really bad English. I apologise. We're no better because when you look at some of the government changes and the helping for international and the funding and the conditions that are put on, and it is very much that we're fighting so much for independence and gender equity. And you do look at the social determinants of health. You do look at the sustainable development goals.
Well, we need it. At the very minimum, we need more women in parliament. I mean, go the Teals, you know. We have to get an even balance of, or even more women would be better. We're probably less likely to see all these world wars. But, midwifery is incredibly political. And, our students usually find that out in about the first week.
And first day.
the first day, And it's important. It's important. And I think we have lost our way as a profession in Australia a little bit. I don't think we're, back in the, I don't know if you were at or remember the big home birth rally, the rally to end all rallies. In Canberra, it was one of the biggest rallies that there ever was. And it was where the consumers worked really closely with the midwifery professions and all of the consumer organisations, Maternity Coalition. We were a really unified voice. And then there was quite a lot of splintering and, we haven't got back to, we haven't regained that power and we need that to happen if we're going to really see a change in women's rights in Australia, which we need to. Medicare is a classic example. Like,
absolutely.
The Medicare, those 18 recommendations fully implemented. We need to see home birth, rolled out so that women can actually be insured so that midwives can, provide it and women have that backup knowledge knowing that there's insurance there for them to have home birth. So we've still got a long way to go in Australia, without a doubt.
Oh, absolutely. I just want to go back to your PhD time because you were doing it over a prolonged period of time and you had different breaks within it to do different activities. How did you keep the momentum going and how did you keep your sanity going when you're in those writing times for your PhD?
Oh, I wasn't a very good writer.
well, that's the reality with a lot of people.
I had to learn to write. I struggled to write. And, like, I wasn't the brightest kid in the group either. Like, I was very average at school. I was average at uni. I had to learn all that sort of stuff and learn to write in a way that is, it's a narrative, it's a story. You've got to make it pithy, particularly these days. God, look at Twitter. You've got to keep it down to just a few characters.
Short 140 characters, get it out.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, you have to learn how to write, and that's tough. You've got to learn how to take criticism from your supervisors, and that's really tough. Mm-hmm. You've got to learn that, you know, your PhD isn't the most important thing in the world, but for, you know, as long as you're enrolled, you think it is.
Yeah.
And to you, it is. So the student cohort made a big difference to us. And what would happen is, you know, we'd gather around. So, you know, one student might have just got a damning review on a paper that they've put in and, you know, be crying and wanting to give up. And, you know, another student might have just got something accepted.
Yep.
So it was about sharing the good and the bad and the ugly and looking after each other. And, you know, I remember at one stage we got pulled in and they wanted us all to come in quite regularly and hear from researchers in that. So it was the nursing, trying to bring the nursing and the midwives together. And, like, initially it's just like, I'd prefer to be at home just writing up this bloody thing. But actually what I learned is about so many different methods and
yeah.
And you're there for research training. You're not really there to change the world, and you've got to remember that at the end of the day. And you've got to be prepared for a lot of things to go wrong because mm-hmm. they always can. You don't always get ethics in the timely fashion that you want it. Governance these days has turned into a nightmare. So you've got to be really keen to do a PhD and very persistent. You don't have to be really, really bright, I don't think. I think you just have to be persistent and passionate and, you know, pretty keen and have a lot of stubbornness, I think, a stubborn streak, and think, I'm going to make this happen, it's going to happen, and believe in yourself enough to know that there's going to be an end point no matter what happens and what goes wrong. I'm not making it sound very attractive, am I?
No, but it is the realism, and I think that a lot of people have said it's the persistence, it's having the team around you to support you. It's not about intelligence, it's not about GPAs. It's about grit and determination to be stubborn enough that I'm going to finish this.
Yeah, and the more midwives we have, the more doctor midwives we have, the better, if you ask me.
Yep.
Like, we do change the world. We can make, we do, you know, one of the best jobs I ever had was as a clinical chair. So these professors that are, it was a joint appointment across the MARTA and the university in Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
So a very large tertiary hospital with, initially it was with ACU, then with University of Queensland. And that was a great job. We had little projects all over the place. You know, MARTA didn't have water birth at the time. Oh, okay, well, we need a water birth study.
Yep.
So, you know, and that was a long, slow, drawn-out study, but by the end of it, we trained, you know, all 150 midwives from the birthing unit, and women were able to access water birth. So, you know, midwifery group practice, oh, we need a study, you know, can we provide it for Aboriginal women? We did a study on young women, on women from a refugee background.
Mm.
We were part of the Mango randomized control trial. So Sally Tracy was in Sydney and we were at the MARTA doing it up there. So we changed our MGPs from low risk to all risk. So I think research can be a really powerful tool to help us change things in Australia.
Well, that's been some of the good comments that I've had from people that have listened to these podcasts and listened to everyone's stories. It's like, I'm actually enthused now. I kind of like, I've listened to their journey that's similar to mine, or I can actually do it. And I think that's it. We can never have too many midwives that have got the, whether it's honours, masters, but involved in research in some level.
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't have to change the world when you're doing research, do you? And, you know, most people won't. But it's learning about it. It's learning to critique it. It's learning to feel confident to be able to stand up in a room of, you know, doctors, and might be doctors, paediatricians, it might be a Pazance or any of these conferences, and say, actually, no, you're interpreting that research mm-hmm. wrong. You know, we should not be inducing all women at 39 weeks. You know, that is bollocks. And this is why.
Yep.
So, you know, it's about being able to ensure that, you know, we are, you know, we really do understand evidence-based practice, and we get our evidence out there and acknowledged and driving practice and practice change. So, you know, midwifery evidence, which, of course, is the oldest and, you know, evidence in the world.
And we've got more and more open access, so it means that more and more of our research can actually be accessed by the women themselves. So yeah, we can actually say if they're reading something off the internet, which has its benefits but also has major downfalls, we can actually go, actually read this instead. This is going to give you kind of the latest information, and being able to critique the sources that way, I think, is one of our most useful skills in helping to improve the care in the future.
Well, we try and do community reports so that, you know, we've got, you know, reports that go out to community for, you know, our big papers, and so that there's, so that it can be go to multiple people. And that the blog that the TTMEC blog, the Trans-Tasman blog that actually does that, so highlights recent research that comes out and does a little blog on it. That, I mean, that's amazing. You know, there's great stuff in midwifery these days where we're actually translating, getting better at translating our research and making sure that more people can read it and see it and access it. Yeah, even if it is not an open access journal, it's on the blog, you know.
It's available. How did you celebrate when you finally finished your PhD? How did you celebrate?
I remember having I've got a photo of myself in my gown and my hat and throwing the hat up in the air at Bondi Beach. So I think I took my parents down to Bondi Beach and had a lunch after graduation. So I did go to graduation. I didn't go to all my graduations for various things, but I did go to my PhD graduation, and I loved it. And, I love throwing that hat up in the air. I'll never forget that day. It's like, I did it, you know. It was a journey, but I did it. So, I mean, I had a lunch with my parents. I went to graduation. I found a mistake in my PhD 24 hours after it had been, you know, fully submitted.
Everyone does that, absolutely.
What was I even doing looking at it? Maybe he's going to read it anyway.
How about the community? How did you celebrate with the community?
In the community, well, it was really going back and explaining things. And in the community, there was more interest in the website than anything else. So the website was really, really important for Molly and for the community. And we actually went from there. It was the beginnings of another big project, to be honest. And that big project, we ended up, because my PhD had, you know, found a lot of the problems and suggested solutions. So where do you go from there? So it's like, how do you strengthen remote area maternity services? Because that's what my whole PhD was on. So, and working with Leslie, I learned about, you know, National Health and Medical Research Council and applying for research grants and what that means and what's involved. And we eventually, and Leslie did actually go up to Charles, she transferred up to Charles Darwin University, and I ended up being the Associate Professor of Midwifery up there, and we redid the graduate diploma, it was back then, and got a big NHMRC study, which was the 1+1 study, which is on our website as well. And that looked at, doing the sort of stuff that Molly and the community wanted. So we went back to and held another big community event and a workshop, and had workshops out at Wadair, workshops at Manangrita, workshops in Darwin. And from there, you know, a report came out with a lot of recommendations, and from there we did this big 5-year study, which was about redesigning the baseline study, really, for a lot of the work I'm doing now. So it was about redesigning the services for women, and we didn't get everything we wanted back then. It was all participatory action research, which is always a bit of a struggle. You never know where you're going to go and where you're going to end up, and that's what happened in my PhD. But what we did is that we ended up setting up a midwifery group practice where the midwives were, any woman coming into Darwin for birth was allocated a midwife, and that midwife was going to be their midwife, and it was like a modified midwifery group practice. We tried to get designated midwives and designated child health nurses in those two communities. They're so big, they needed one of each. So a midwife that didn't have to be a nurse midwife, could be a BMid graduate, just somebody who was able to do midwifery and not get pulled off to acute nursing all the time. So, and the projects have just gone on from there. So we learned enormous amounts in that project, and that informed the next project and the next project. And here we are again, still trying to, now we want to reopen birthing services in Galawinku. So the community have spoken, this is what they want. They want a birth centre out there. It's a small community. There's a large burden of disease. It's probably going to be the hardest project we ever do, mm-hmm. but we're going to give it a red hot go. And we've got all the parties on board at the moment for our next project. You know, NT Health, MeWatch, the Aboriginal Community Control Organisation, CareFly, Red Cross, Yalu. There's another one on the website. So that we've just got funding for that just now. So it's a 5-year study.
Yep.
And watch this space. Anyone wants to come and do their PhD or their master's with us, they can come to Alice Springs, you know, Darwin, Nowra, any of these sites. We're definitely interested in people who are interested in, you know, social justice and remote or rural or birthing on country, really.
Which is going to be my kind of next question, is how do people get involved in what you're doing? So that's kind of get in contact with you.
Yeah, we've got some projects listed on the website. We're updating it all the time. You know, getting contact with any of the team or our people on the Molly website. And we're going to have a big Birthing on Country workshop gathering here in Mbatwe and Alice Springs in October this year. So it's 10 years since the first and only National Birthing on Country Conference.
Oh, wow.
Here in Alice Springs 10 years ago. And that's when the guidelines came out for the Birthing on Country, the first workshop, the literature review and the guidelines for implementation and evaluation. So it is going to be in, I'm just checking the dates as we speak. So it's October, the 11th. So the October the 10th, 11th, 12th, it'll be here. There's, you can sign up on our website and get information about it.
That'll be the Molly website?
The Molly website. And
so that's current research? You
write MWRC.
Birthing on Country.
Or you can just write to MWRC at cdu.edu.au and that will, you can get put on our mailing list and get all the updates. Yeah, so we're planning that gathering. That's going to be really exciting. And from there, we want to end up come out with a report for the next 10 years, you know, what needs to happen next.
Well, I was going to ask you what's next, but you've kind of covered that. You've got the amazing things. Now, this latest grant, that's about 148 million that you've got, was it? 105 million.
I wish it was 148 million. Then we'd be able to see birthing on country sites across the country, wouldn't we?
We would.
Or a few at least. No, it's 5 million. Which is big for a grant. That's always big for a grant. We're excited about that. I mean, I'd love to, you know, for somebody like a philanthropist to just come along and give me 148 million or give us 148 million, but no, 5 million. So, you know, we don't provide the service at the end of the day. We bring people together and redesign and, you know, try and, you know, get just redesign, really. It's through redesigning because we don't have big buckets of money, but we provide the technical help and expertise and, you know, the support, the monitoring, the, you know, data collection, the analysis, the monitoring, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, very exciting. All that, always action research pretty much. So it's messy, but it's fun.
And it's passionate, which is kind of what research ultimately ends up being, is you've got a passion to answer a question or to solve a problem or to fill a gap.
That's it.
Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Yeah, good on you for doing these podcasts. It's so important, such important work. So thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for asking me and hunting me down. It's it's been a
pleasure. Oh, I keep joking, in a way I'm joking, but it's professional girl fanning and stalking, because it's kind of like all these people that I'm fascinated by their careers, and it's just like, yep, you're next and you're next. And it's the same on Twitter. I've got a list of about 16 people that people have said, right, I want to hear this person's story. I want to hear what their journey is, because We do. We want to share, and we are communal, and we are quite small within an international progress. And so the learning of the stories.
We tell stories,
and that's what people like listening to.
Good on you. Well done, Liz. So it's been a pleasure, absolute pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.